This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Over these weeks on this program, we're featuring important American composers, alternating with weeks with great instrumentalists, conductors, and singers. This week is the conclusion of last week's A Composer program, as we'll conclude our chat with a musician who has been called American music's Renaissance man, composer, conductor, multi-instrumentalist, and author David Amram. Now, in his 87th year, he is releasing his fourth book called The Next 80 Years, and you couldn't pack more into his first four score. Last week, he talked about growing up on a farm just north in Philly in Lower Bucks County. His home life was surrounded by music from Jewish liturgical to classical. He recalled the story of his father after toiling the soil on the farm would try to play through the Brahms First Symphony at the piano to jazz. My guest started as a French horn player in the National Symphony Orchestra, but was also performing jazz and became the first noted improvising jazz French horn player. He would move in artistic circles that would have him working with a list of artists that include the likes of Dizzy Gillespie, Lionel Hampton, Willie Nelson, Langston Hughes, Charles Mingus, Levon Helm, Betty Carter, and the writer-poet Jack Kerouac, with whom in 1957 my guest started the jazz poetry readings in New York City and the Beat Movement was born. Great musicians like Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk were mentors. He also worked with Dimitri Metropoulos, Aaron Copland, Gunther Schuller, and more than a few eyebrows were raised when Leonard Bernstein named him the first composer in residence for the New York Philharmonic back in 1966. He already had some noted film scores under his belt, such as The Manchurian Candidate and Splendor in the Grass. My guest has composed more than 100 orchestral and chamber works, and a new CD has been released on the Effetto label, chronicling his chamber music spanning these many decades. On last week's program, we were working our way through the recording, and you're listening now to the final minutes of the 1979 work titled Portraits for Piano Quartet, featuring the New York Piano Quartet, Elmira Darvarova on violin, Ronald Carbone on viola, Samuel McGill on cello, and Thomas Weaver on piano. My guest's American roots are widely evident in his music, as is the culture of many different countries and societies around the globe, as he has traveled to more than 80 countries as a music ambassador and was one of the first group of artists after the Castro regime took hold to travel to Cuba back in the 1970s. In a word, he has accomplished and done a lot. This is a conclusion, then, of my chat with my guest. I met up with him in New York City a few months back.
Thank you. The next piece, jumped to 1979. This is this Portraits for Piano Quartet, which is just a simply gorgeous piece. I mean, it just
simply is.
And I think that underlines just sort of your credo in whatever style you're composing in, which is just to create beauty, right? That's just two words is kind of sums up your idea of composition.
Also structure. I remember Eric Friedman, wonderful, he's not here anymore, unfortunately. He played my violin sonata, and he'd only seen me playing jazz, and which I'm proud and thrilled to be able to do, and doing other things. And he said, this is actually a very classical piece. And I said, well, that's melody, harmony, counterpoint, sonata form, Theban variations, all those things are there for a reason, because they've been effective for the last few hundred years. And if you don't have a beginning, a middle, and end, I think in some kind of a formal structure, then it's just going to be noodling around. Or you could just improvise and create something really terrific, because the fact that you're doing it for the first and only time means you're not ever trying to say, I wish I had done this or that. You've already done it. And with composing, you have a second, third, fourth, and 28th chance. The thing about Vivaldi, I think why people love his music so much is, or Mozart, it just sounds like they're sitting there and jamming. It just seems so natural. And of course, they were...
jamming with a fingerprint that you know.
Oh, yeah, they were working, you know, as musicians and playing with other people.
Yeah, sure.
And they were in the world of music and had something. And Bach was, you know, a church organist, and his club date orchestra played a dinner party. Instead of a bar mitzvah or a wedding, it was a Tafelmusik, they called it, table music for the Margrave of Brandenburg. No one knows what the Margrave of Brandenburg served for dinner that night, which must have been delicious, but we all know what the dinner music was, because Bach exceeded the nature of the gig.
Yeah, like a good musician, Bach didn't get the gig. He didn't get the job. The other two pieces, we jump all the way to present time, and the 2016 work, the Three Lost Loves, all three movements talk about different relationships from different sources. The interesting about this piece, and I'm going to throw you this kind of, a little bit of curveball, we mentioned his name earlier, but what you can hear in this piece is tracing various parts of our musical heritage, north and south of the border and all the rest of that. You're an interesting person, because Antonin Dvorak, when he came here in the 1890s, was teaching in New York. Here's this great European symphonist and composer, you know, and all the American composers trained were trying to write like he was, or Brahms and Mendelssohn. But he gets exposed through Harry Burley to African-American spirituals. Yeah. He hears Native American music. He says, this is your music. It's so rich. Follow this vein. So that happens a little bit, except it doesn't really happen in the 20th century. It gets sidetracked. Gershwin is really the person who you could maybe draw a connection to. But Copland and the rest, they want to be modernists. They want to be Stravinsky. You, I think, come pretty close to pulling the line through. I don't know what you think about that. Because we didn't go in that path. We didn't follow our roots music and say, this is such a rich thing, we need to explore this. It was dead-ended, got co-opted by other things throughout the 20th century. But that doesn't follow through for you.
Well, thank you. It's only because I did, I guess what you say comes naturally. And when I heard a lot of the 12-tone music, I loved Albert Baer because it was so emotional.
Yeah.
But a lot of the other music, I thought, well, that's what they felt. But they already did that. And some of it, without sounding sacrilegious, not only didn't move me, I wanted to move out and hear something else. And I did all the time, but music from all over, every place I traveled in the world, that was so beautiful. And it wasn't always that simple either, for people to say, wow, he likes jazz and blues and this and that. He must be a simplistic person, you know, that says, run, Spot, run. Jack and Jill go up the hill, and that's the extent of their literary capabilities or whatever. I heard things that were so sophisticated and so beautiful and so moving, not to mention a lot of other music that was also written, because there were other composers besides those three. And then hearing all the wonderful Russian composers like Shostakovich and Prokofiev and Glier and all these other people who were writing this fantastic, and Puccini, who I was told in music school wore his heart on his sleeve, whatever that means, and was basically a songwriter and didn't use enough counterpoint or contrary motion. And you hear that music and it just kills you. And those things that he wrote, and the Pines of Rome, or the Spigi, some of those things are so fantastic. I said, wait a minute, there's other stuff written that's worthy of study and to listen to. And Stravinsky's earlier pieces, The Firebird, those things are so gorgeous. And I heard that. Then when I heard Miles Davis, that Birth of the Cool record in 1949, I heard that incredible harmonies and the counter, or stuff that they wrote, not just what they played. I said, wow, there's a lot of possibilities out there. And the harmonic sense that Thelonious Monk had and that Dizzy Gillespie also feasted upon. One time when Dizzy was playing the piano and he came to hear my symphony pieces and everything, he was one of my mentors just for living and for beauty and appreciation of people and everything. He was sitting at the piano. He was sort of like my father. He would spend an hour until he got the right note, blang, blang, clonk. Then he would play some fantastic chord and then move. I said, your voicing of chords is so extraordinary. And he turned to me very seriously and said, man, I'm a harmony freak. And I loved that because he actually was saying he really cared about harmony. And Thelonious Monk, who I knew, was like phenomenal. And it wasn't just somebody hitting the piano and being crazy. He had this extraordinary sonic sense of structure and harmony that was just so beautiful. And then when you hear Dvorak's music itself, and we were always told from our bad education, coming 12th hand from people who'd forgotten what it was all about in the first place, that Dvorak was a minor composer. He didn't work in a mine. I don't know where that came from. But anyway, his music was so, and Smetana and all those people, they were so terrific. I said, you know, I better study them too. And then I heard Maurice Perez, who just passed away, was the one who told me about going to Spillville, which I did, and seeing the picture of the Dvorak when he spent that one summer in the middle of Iowa with a group of Kickapoo Indians who were traveling, and the look on his face standing there in that beautiful Czech overcoat, because he always maintained his Czech identity, just with his mouth open, staring. And then a picture of Mr. Burleigh, the great African-American singer who sang the spirituals and taught him about that. And Dvorak was saying, and they're in the letters, you know, that for American composers, we have a rich palette to draw from, right, not to take the European music and throw it in the wastebasket. Well, that was the 1960s fake version of saying, well, all classical music is by dead white male European composers, so you have to throw that away. That has nothing to do with anything except ignorance and people that never learned to sing and dance trying to use something for their, whatever their political agenda is, for the moment to get some attention by, you know, taking what is considered to be beautiful all over the world and saying now it's time to put that in the dumpster and replace it with something else that's hipper. To which I always tell students, go see the Lascaux cave paintings. They're 25,000 years old. People still go every summer and get knocked out by them. They're still relevant because John Keats said a thing of beauty is a joy forever, and forget about everything else.
There's a good train of scholarly thought that Dvorak might have lived up to his speaking in that he wanted to do a Hiawatha opera.
Yeah.
And that actually the New World Symphony is that piece. That's what turned out anyway.
And it's so beautiful.
Yeah,
it's
Here is a work by my guest, David Amram, paying tribute to one of the great Latin jazz pioneers, Cuban jazz percussionist, singer, dancer, and composer, and the first Latin percussionist to appear in an American jazz group headed by Dizzy Gillespie. This is En Memoria di Chano Pozzo, performed by the Indiana University of Pennsylvania Wind Ensemble, Jack Stamp conducting, with Tony Glover piano and Carl Adam flute. Thank you.
mentioned all these jazz greats, and you don't have to comment on this, but I think our listeners should hear that a lot of these great jazz artists you worked with and knew were great fans of classical composers.
Yeah,
Charlie Parker turned you on to Frederick Delius, and no one could ever think that up.
No, I was shocked. About 3 a.m, he said, "Man, check out Frederick Delius." I said, "He said not just the Cuckoo in Spring." He said, "Check out his sense of orchestral colors."
Right.
I said, "Wow!" I had to have Charlie Parker tell me to listen to Frederick Delius a little closer and listen to it and see what he did. Right. That was so amazing.
You could put those artists in column A and column B, and no one would ever draw the lines. But that's a great story.
And Charlie Parker, like Dizzy and everyone else, loved Bartok.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I always did too. And Bartok had a lot of troubles because he had his own way of doing things, and he didn't follow any group or change his music because he thought he had to. And I don't criticize people that did, because we all have to survive and feed our families.
Yeah.
But if you allow other people who don't know much about anything to tell you who and what you're supposed to be, most of the people who do know something will encourage you to be yourself and then improve yourself your whole life so that yourself can become a better person, but not to become a bad imitation of what someone says is the flavor of the month. Because I've found, from especially being 87, that what is today's fashion usually ends up in tomorrow's landfill. And what's beautiful stays beautiful. And if it takes a while to get what you're doing appreciated, Moses was in the desert 40 years. So sometimes a time delay means you're right on schedule.
No, composers know it. Composers know it takes a while. The last two tracks on the disc are reworkings of what you did with Jack Kerouac 60 years earlier, Two Such and Some on the Road. They're narrated by the great actress, I guess now director, Stella Parsons. I'm not the first one to probably put this to you, but and maybe you refute it, but when you were doing that with Jack, could you have any inkling, now that you've lived this long life, that come around the 1980s, that this would start to appear in African-American societies as poetry turning into rap, turning into hip-hop, the same type of thing which you sort of got off the ground and started, would reemerge there 30 years later?
Well, I took the starter, because when I wrote a cantata with Langston Hughes in 1965, before he passed away, he liked Jack Kerouac, and he said, tell Jack to stick to his guns and not to be dissuaded from criticism. He said, you know, I'm criticized now for writing those Semple columns for the New York Post. He said, to me, the character of Semple is a beautiful, poetic person who's just a street person, and what he's saying is what many of us feel, and he says it in a very poetic way. Of course, Langston was a poet, too, but he knew about the jazz poetry we had done in 1957, which was 8 years before we collaborated on the cantata, Let Us Remember. And Langston said, you know, in the, what they called the Harlem Renaissance, which of course we didn't call it, we were just hanging out with each other, they used to have rent parties where everybody would come and they'd contribute, you know, a meal or a dollar or something, and then they would have a great big party, and that would raise enough money for the person where the party was being held to pay their rent, and turn it into kind of a celebration, like the bring-your-own-bottle parties where I met Jack Kerouac. Yeah. And he said, in the rent parties, we always did that. We had people get up and read a poem, and someone would play music. And that's been going along for a long time. And then if you study ancient history and see that Homer was not sighted, he couldn't see. So when he was rapping or freestyling the Iliad and the Odyssey, and someone wrote some of it down, accompanied by a lira player, or probably two or three, because to do 2,000 pages of backup would be kind of tiring. That's been going on since the beginning of time. In King David's Songs of Solomon, we read he was always accompanied by a harpist. So what Jack and I did just started out when I was at a bring-your-own-bottle party, and he handed me something and said, play for me. And I just got that good feeling. And we used to do that just for fun everywhere. Park benches, coffee houses, people's homes, until we were asked to leave. When we did the formal ones, it said, Jazz Poetry Trio. I said, look, there's Philip Lamatea, Howard Hart, Jack Kerouac, and myself. That's four. He said, yeah, but if someone doesn't show up, we'll still be a trio. So we became the Jazz Poetry Trio. And then that became a big thing after On the Road came out and made him famous. And suddenly, someone who'd never even read or read would get up, or written a poem, would get up and say, I hate my mother, I hate America, blah, blah, honking and foaming into the microphone, screaming while the band was playing, I got rhythm three times faster than the gold Olympic record. And after about 2 months, jazz poetry became unfashionable before it even had a chance to become fashionable. But I continued doing that with Jack just for fun and at different places and with other people. And on this recording, since I had done that for Elmira by a miracle at some of her concerts, we'd have a little something. She said, I'd love to have some of those readings. And my instinct was, no, I want this just to be formal, written down music. And then I figured, well, she's more than pretty smart. Maybe I better just shut up and listen to someone else's opinion. And Estelle Parsons I'd known 60 years, and she'd asked me to be in a production of Uncle Vanya and act in it as well as doing the music. I said, well, my gosh, I haven't been acting since the 10th grade when I was in production of Richard II as Bushy, and I wasn't very good. That ended my stage career. She said, no, you can do it. I'll tell you what to do. So sure enough, it was a life-changing experience just being with those great actors. And the one day that she had off, she said, since you came and were in Uncle Vanya and did all that, I can give you the afternoon. And she decided to read it. I was listening to the CD and hearing the whole thing with all that great playing, and then having her come in at the very end was perfect. And I never would have dared to have done that myself.
Was your original resistance to that just didn't want to revisit it, or what?
Oh no, I do it all the time, but I thought maybe that might not fit. It might not fit the rest of the recording, or it might not fit those great classical players, or it might be better to do it in a different setting. And I saw she was right and I was wrong, and thought of something I never not only would have thought of, but wouldn't have dared to do. And I mention that because sometimes it's possible to listen to other people and see what they have to offer. That's scarcely a revolutionary thought, but you can become narrow-minded and bigoted. And I think we all have a tendency to do that. So sometimes it's good just to take a deep breath and say, maybe we should try to do that. And I only say that because people think I'm open-minded and freewheeling and everything. But actually, I have to struggle every day not to just become a soured, narrow-minded, bigoted creep. Because essentially, that's what you're programmed to think you might be able to become if you're lucky. And I don't say that disparagingly, but just for people who want to be artists or listen, it's a lifetime pursuit. And as long as you're inhaling and exhaling, you can get better. And if you could hang out with people who are better than you, that's the best thing that you can do.
Turning back to that new recording on the Effetto label of my guest's chamber music from 1958 to 2017, here are two excerpts from Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Music by my guest, David Amram, who's on the piano. The voice, that of noted actress and director Estelle Parsons. We'll hear Children of the American Bop Night, and the second selection is also the title of the CD, So in America.
Once there was Louis Armstrong blowing his beautiful top in the muds of New Orleans. Before him, the mad musicians who had paraded on official days and broke up the Sousa marches into ragtime. Then there was swing and Roy Eldridge, vigorous and virile, blasting the horn for everything it had in waves of power and logic and subtlety. Leaning to it with glittering eyes and a lovely smile, and sending it out broadcast to rock the jazz world. Then had come Charlie Parker, a kid in his mother's woodshed in Kansas City, blowing his taped-up alto among the logs, practicing on rainy days, coming out to watch the old swinging Basie and Benny Moten band that had Hot Lips Page and the rest. Charlie Parker leaving home and coming to Harlem and meeting Mad Thelonious Monk and Madder Gillespie. Charlie Parker in his early days when he was flipped and walked around in a circle while playing. somewhat younger than Lester Young, also from KC. That gloomy, saintly goof in whom the history of jazz was wrapped. For when he held his horn high and horizontal from his mouth, he blew the greatest. And as his hair grew longer, and he got lazier and stretched out, his horn came down to halfway, till it finally fell all the way. And today he wears his thick-soled shoes so that he can't feel the sidewalks of life. His horn is held weakly against his chest, and he blows cool and easy get-out phrases. Here were the children of the American bop night. So, in America, when the sun goes down and I sit in the old broken-down river pier watching the long, long skies over New Jersey and sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievable huge bulge over to the West Coast and all that road going, all the people dreaming in the immensity of it. And in Iowa, I know by now, the children must be crying in the land where they let the children cry. And tonight, the stars will be out. And don't you know that God is Pooh Bear? Evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkled dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore in. And nobody, nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. I think of Dean Moriarty. I even think of old Dean Moriarty, the father we never found. I think of Dean Moriarty.
So your career, you could, in, you know, the street lingo, you could wrap up as saying, you know, been there, done that. I mean, I don't know people that have done quite as much as you did. Well, are you still working on the David Amram, The Next 80 Years? Is that, that's the book, right?
Yeah, well, I missed my deadline. It was supposed to come out with the film,
yeah.
David Amram, the first 80 years, but I couldn't get it done on time. So my publisher said, well, look, why don't you make it the next 80 years? That means if you get it done before you're 160, you'll be right on schedule. Yeah. I said, okay. So
that gives you a lot of leeway.
I couldn't figure out again what to do. And I started trying to go through old papers and diaries. Sure enough, my 80th birthday took place in San Antonio, Texas, November 17th. Ken Radnofsky, the great saxophone player, who's on Elmira's recording for Affetto, the wonderful saxophone player, was doing a premiere of Ode to Lord Buckley, which was supposed to have been done 2 weeks earlier or something, but they had to change the date, as orchestras often have to do, you know. And by a coincidence, so I said to my publisher, that could be a great way to start the book, showing at that point when I'm supposed to either call the embalmer or just be depressed and retired, I'm actually starting on a new venture. And he said, that's great. So I saw him recently when I was in Denver doing some concerts there, and we're going to start the book starting from there when I was 80, and then going to all the things I've done in the past 7 years. and referring back to things that, how they sometimes relate to stuff I did 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, which didn't turn out to be a waste of time. So my hope is it'll inspire younger people, first of all, to try to make it till 80 or beyond. Secondly, people who were as old as me, not to say it's all over. And third of all, just to share some of my blessings, to encourage other people to hang in there and do what they love to do and not give up and not allow themselves to be talked out of doing what we all have to offer.
Yeah. I'm not sure this last question has an answer, but I mean, your life is pretty singular. I mean, you have to be, and you just said the blessings, but I mean, could someone today live a life like you had, knowing all the people you met, worked with, and, you know, through that whole stretch of the 20th century, the mid-20th century?
I think so. I think that there are a lot of people that are that way, that just nobody knows about them. Because there are a lot of terrific people out there that aren't acknowledged, but are terrific people. And sometimes the acknowledgement destroys more than it enhances, because then you're told, now it's time to move to the next level. And the minute you do that, that means abandoning your family, your friends, all the people who care about you, all the people who can say, man, you're really getting to be a creep. Go apologize to that person for being so disrespectful. You won't have any people like that surrounding you if you allow yourself to be put on someone else's supposedly higher level, which is very often quite adjacent to their own personal cesspool.
I think they would need what you've had all your life to the hilt is creative curiosity, which means you have the confidence to say, I'm going to go try it. I'm going to go to Brazil. I'm going to go to Kenya. I'm going to go study Native American. I'm going to work with these jazz artists in the basement of your place.
Oh, well, I don't interrupt you. I didn't decide to do that. I was invited.
Well, okay.
Or lucky enough to stumble into it very often.
Some of the things you did on your own volition of, I want to find this out. I want to find out about this.
I wanted to find it out once I got there. Okay. But I never would have gone there if someone had to say, would you like to come? Because I don't barge into places and say, hi, everybody, here's my brochure. Do you know who I am? I've seen people like that. And frankly, they're not only unpleasurable to be with, but they're guaranteed not to find out or learn anything because they repulse people. Unless you have to be the person that they're seeking out, and then you can understand, well, they're struggling and they want to get something and they can't really be that awful. They just don't know how to say please and thank you. So then you try to, you know, help out. But if you're on the other end, it's always best to be asked. I've had so many times people say, are you going to play with them? I'll say, if I'm invited, I say I don't barge in on someone else's music. And I said, sometimes somebody that you know who might be playing or performing might think it might be nice, but you want to be there because you'd like to hear them do what they've been struggling to do all your life. And you have to overcome that desire to say, I want to get up there. I want to do that too. Even if you feel that way, you have to quell that and you don't hold up your instrument or start waving or, you know, you try to be respectful. And conversely, I usually have some instrument with me hidden somewhere. If they say, would you like to play? I don't say, call up my manager, my career counselor, or my guru. I don't have a guru, fortunately, or a career counselor. I have a manager as my friend I've been known for 30 years before we ever worked together, who also loves music. But basically, I'm enthusiastic, but I've tried to learn to cool it and to be respectful of others.
Well, as per your publisher, you've got like 73 more years of being creative, so, you know.
I hope.
You get that double 80 mark. So hopefully we'll have a lot more from you.
Here's my guest, David Amram, performing music of one of the jazz giants he worked with his quartet of Victor Venegas on bass, Akira Tana drums, Vic Juris guitar, Paquita de Rivera on saxes and clarinets, and my guest on piano and percussion. This is David Amram's arrangement of Sonny Rollins' tune, St. Thomas. Thank you.
It's really great to meet you and great to talk with you. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat, just like we've been chatting, you're one of these people who have known and met and worked with so many great artists. But if you could chat with someone from the past that you never had a chance to, when I ask that, what's the first name that pops in your head?
Guillaume Dimasho.
Really?
Yeah. How he could write those harmonies.
He also wrote 900-line love poems.
Yeah, I mean, any time. Some of his harmonies, you know,
yeah,
all those hundreds of years before Bach.
Yeah.
I remember hearing the Crucifixus and then the Et Resurrexit, the B minor Mass. I said, boy, that end of that Crucifixus and then those trumpets coming in, that was the most dramatic, extraordinary harmonic thing. And then hearing Thelonious Monk, who was sort of like Guillaume de Machaut, everything was different, but it was all right. I thought I'd like to hang out with Guillaume de Machaut and sort of ask him what he was thinking and how he managed not to get fired, being able to do...
Well, he was a brilliant PR because he attached himself to this court that traveled a lot, so he had to put his music everywhere they stopped. So he's a smart guy. Yeah, well, I mean, that stark ideas of what he had, which... you are the first in all these years to pick Machaut. So, final question is non-musical. And, you know, you've had a lot of time. When you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but pull yourself away, respite of some kind, what do you do that can free your mind up when it needs to be free?
Well, when I can't visit my grandson so I can study him ignoring me, I study him because I see that while he seems to be ignoring everybody, he's always looking. When he doesn't think that you see him looking, and he's absorbing everything, which reaffirms what Charlie Chin told me a long time ago, a wonderful Asian-American guitar player I worked with for years. And he said, you know, in our culture, we take the eggs and put those in the ground sometimes for a year because the osmosis of the treasures of the earth enter into the egg. And when you eat that egg, it's full of magnificent elements that the egg itself might not have before it's immersed. And he said, with our kids, even if they look like they're not paying attention, we try to take them to every experience that's beautiful. And even if it looks like they're not paying attention, by the process of that same osmosis for the egg, it enters into them and becomes part of their life. And like years later, before you know about that. So I'm always trying myself, not only to see my grandson, but to immerse myself in things that are beautiful. And hopefully in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, they'll enter into my DNA and I can make better decisions instinctively because of what that beauty has osmosed into me without my even knowing it.
Well, thanks for taking some time.
All right, thank you.
Composer David Amram. You can find out more about him at his website, davidamram.com. The new recording, from which we've been sampling over these 2 weeks, So in America, Selected Chamber Music Compositions 1958 to 2017, is on the Effetto label, founded and run by our good friend, recording engineer John Baker. Check out that recording and all the Effetto releases at Effetto Recordings, AFFETTO.com. Effetto is also distributed by Naxos, so you can find these releases at Naxos.com. I'll leave you with the same jazz quartet we just heard in music my guest composed for a film, a tune which came to be known as the anthem of the Beat Generation, words by Jack Kerouac, Neil Cassidy, and Allen Ginsberg, music from 1959. This is Pull My Daisy by my guest today, David Amram. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.
Hop my heart, heart my life. Sarah's hope is steady. Hit my angel, heart my light. Lay it on the needy. Well, when Jack and Neil and Al and I wrote this song back in 1959, we never thought it would be a music fest tonight. And seeing all of you at this beautiful place on this August Eve is out of sight. Because the music has been going all the daytime as well. And in the afternoon we have nothing to sell, because there's only the stories of the music to tell. And that really is truly all right, because Music Fest is the best. You could come in short pants or a cocktail and vest. It doesn't matter how you dress anyway, because the sunshine in your heart brings each brand new day the spirit of what it is all about. And if Jack himself were here, he'd be sitting in on the cougar drums and sharing in this cosmic cheer. Because they used to make all the words of music up to, just like now we're going to do. It's called improvising or spontaneity, and you can do it without having to pull your daisy, because it's so much fun. You won't have to worry about the battles that are lost or the ideas that are won, because it comes in its natural way. There's not really too much left to say, except that if you think that the 1950s were a drag, you're probably right, but still was, they were out of sight because they had a different type of bag. We all used it together like this August beautiful weather. Whether you were from Pennsylvania, New York, didn't matter anything. It only meant that you had spent as part of your tether. You were tethered to the rope of reality. It was also connected with spontaneity. There's not much more that we have to say, because now we can hear Mr. Victor's play. Tip my cup, all my doors are open. Hop my heart for coconuts, all my eggs are broken. Hop my heart, heart my light, Cyril's hope is steady. Hip my angel, heart my light, lay it on the needy. Hop my heart, heart my light, Cyril's hope is steady. Hip my angel, heart my light, lay it on the needy. And That's the way they used to scat sing back in 1952. And now, in this beautiful August night in 1988, when none of us should really, at our ages, be up this late, we think about Jack back in the 1950s, going to those New York City cocktail parties with a tweed coat with patches and a sleeve, playing that Edwardian English 19th century game of literary make-believe. And Truman Capote said it wasn't writing, it was typing. And now Truman Capote's gone up into the great jam session in the sky while Jack's 11 books are in paperback, and make everyone not have to ask the question why. So for all of you here at Music Festival, want to write, paint, sing, or get one more rototilling in before the fall comes so you can be prepared for the next corn crop next spring, we're so glad to be here one more time again, and we hope until we come one more time back. Till then, we know that you want to have something spontaneity. Let's all pull our daisy.